You're listening to BBC London 94.9. And this is My London with Gary Crowley.
Hello and welcome to My London Indeed with me, Gary Crowley. Now, over this series of specials, we're meeting Londoners and asking them what it is that connects them to this great city of ours. And they're choosing the music. And we'll be hearing the stories behind those songs. And joining me, I'm very pleased to say, for the next 1 hour, is singer-songwriter Adam Ant. Hello.
Hiya.
All right, good to see you. It's been a while.
Yes, quite a while, Gary.
Yeah, it has been a while. Yeah. Looking good, still looking good. What was I going to say? It's all been go for you over the last, well, not only this year, but the last couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah, just getting a band together and getting back on the road live, you know. Decided to go the old route, you know, sort of do the play to the audience first, see who was still interested. And
a lot of people are as well, aren't they? I mean, you've just completed a UK tour, sold out, and also you've been around the world, haven't you?
Yeah, the States and Australia. And that was great. It's more or less sort of, you know, been away that long. I just wanted to choose the stuff that I like playing from my catalogue, which is, there's 9 albums to choose from. And just drop 1 or 2 tracks in the new album. So just little tasters. Just get a feel of what it's like live, you know.
All right. Well, we'll talk about the new album a little bit later. I mean, talk about 10 out of 10 in the, you know, the album title department, folks. Adam Ant is the blueback hussar in Marion, the Gunner's Daughter. Yeah. We'll talk about, like I said, that album and what we can expect a little bit later on. But just looking back at this time of year, Adam, you know, kind of Christmas, the new year, a great time for reflection, I guess, for some people. I mean, you know, how's 2012 been for you, looking back over it?
It's really just getting back to, you know, going on stage and committing to doing, putting a new band together and going out there has just been the kind of, the basis of it, the thing that I think I probably do best and the thing that is the most rewarding. It's like running a marathon every night, that relief you must get after running a marathon. It's a similar kind of thing after doing the show. So it's the physical thing and the emotional thing, and you're actually seeing the audience, you're seeing the face, the reaction to the work, and it's the bare bones, you know.
I mean, there was a big gap before, you know, since last time that you toured. I mean, did you miss it? I mean, was it sort of something that was always kind of niggling at the back of your mind?
I didn't miss it for the first kind of 5 or 6 years of not doing it. But as time progressed, I really, you know, started to. There's something that one of the good things about being a performer is you kind of express a lot of emotions that you can't express in any other avenue of life. You can't go out in the street and have that kind of energy. And like I say, you know, some people run marathons, some people, you know, build houses or whatever. They test their body physically and they test their ability, but. I kind of missed it. It's a way of expressing things, and it's a way of getting out all the kind of emotions that you have as a human. So it's a great, it's a wonderful thing to. I now kind of appreciate the gift that it is to be able to do it.
You know? And easy physically, kind of getting back into the you know, the swing of doing it. I mean, I remember seeing you know, Adam and the Ants at the Marquee. I remember seeing the around about the time of the Kings of the Wild Frontier tour at the Dominion. I remember the Prince Charming review at the Drury Lane Theatre, which I could tell you about. But I'll tell you about that during our next record. But you know, you give plenty on stage as well. So, I mean, is it easy? I mean, do you need to sort of kind of put yourself into, you know, kind of top physical mode to be able to do it now?
Yeah.
None of us are getting any younger.
It's an hour 45 to 2 hours a night. And it's, you know, you're just being careful what you eat. I don't go into any kind of, you know, there's certain. It's really the limbering up exercises and just being careful, you know.
Yeah, looking after yourself.
Just, you know, having a good breakfast every day on the road, trying to eat as best you can, you know, decent food before you go on, a few hours before. And the most difficult thing is the travelling, you know. It's just the travelling, the actual going from A to B to C is the test. So but I've got my own label and I can sort of decide what I want to do and what I don't want to do. It's been a lot more sensible, if you know what I mean.
Learning how to say no to things, because I know you've talked about this in the past.
Absolutely.
But you know, during the whole mania thing, I mean, you know, you didn't have a holiday for 3 years or so.
No. Now I kind of enjoy. I try to do as much of the kind of interviews and promotions and stuff before I do the show, before I do the tour. So then, when I just do the tour, I can really just concentrate on the live stuff.
Yeah.
Because I think they're two different animals, you know, to promote, and the sort of energy you need to get ready for an interview. It's very, very important. it's almost like a, not a performance, but it's very, very time consuming. And I think that before I was doing both. I was doing, you know, the live show and then doing a bunch of interviews before that. So I didn't, that's how I got into a position where I wasn't having any rest.
Yeah.
So now I really enjoy doing the promotion before, you know, the tour, and then you just go out there and play live because you've already spoken to the people that are coming.
Yes.
You've had a relationship with the reviewers or whatever, and then you just do the show. So that's made it, in answer to your question, it's, I'm actually playing probably longer sets now than ever before, and I'm still standing after 3 months of solid touring. So that, you know, that's the test.
Well, stay sat for the next hour. Very excited about the choice of music. We're going to start with Southwest London Boy, I think I'm right in saying, Noel Coward. A song called London Pride. Why have you chosen this one? What does this say about London for you, Adam?
Well, he was a lyricist. He was, you know, there aren't that many songs specifically about London written by people that lived in London, and he kind of reigned in London. You know, he was the king of theatre. He was the darling of theatre, and he had this wit and this humour that he's like an Oscar Wilde character. I mean, we now have Stephen Fry, I think, who's a similar kind of person. But Noel Coward was an incredibly versatile writer, performer, filmmaker. And, you know, I think he ended up, you know, playing in Las Vegas, kind of selling this whole, you know, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, this wonderful voice. And he kind of came from, he didn't really come from that background. He kind of he invented himself. But I think there was a wonderful quote he said from childhood. He was always told he was a genius, even from a little child. If he did a drawing or wrote something, his family told him, you're a genius. And so he kind of grew up with believing that he had this kind of special quality. And I think he's got a sense of humour that and a pronunciation when you hear him, you know, he's the only person you can listen to who more or less talks, but he's got this beautiful voice. He doesn't really have to sing, he can just, you know, take it up a level.
No one else sounds like him.
And this one was written, I think it's 1941 or something, so it was written at a time when London was getting, you know, is getting destroyed. Which is a kind of, and I remember Sunday, you know, the black and white film, there'd be, you know, all the films he was in, these wartime films, black and white films they made. And, you know, he had exactly the same accent in it, and didn't get a chance to sing in them, but it's nice to actually have a song by him.
London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Woe, Liza, see the Costa barrels, the vegetable marrows, and the fruit piled high. Oh, Liza, little London sparrows, Covent Garden Market where the costas cry. Cockney feet mark the beat of history, every street pins a memory down. Nothing ever can quite replace the grace of London town. There's a little city flower every spring unfailing, growing in the crevices by some London railing. Though it has a Latin name, in town and countryside, we in England call it London Pride. London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Hey, lady, when the day is dawning, see the policeman yawning on his lonely beat. Gay lady, Mayfair in the morning, hear your footsteps echo in the empty street. Early rain and the pavement's glistening, all Park Lane in a shimmering gown. Nothing ever could break or harm the charm of London town. In our city darkened now, street and square and crescent, we can feel our living past in our shadowed present. ghosts beside our starlit Thames, who lived and loved and died, keep throughout the ages London Pride. London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be. Grey city, stubbornly implanted, taken so for granted for a thousand years. Stay city, smokily enchanted, cradle of our memories, our hopes and fears. Every blitz your resistance toughening, from the Ritz to the Anchor and Crown, nothing ever could override the pride of London Town.
BBC London 94.9, and it's My London with yours truly, Gary Crowley, and Adamant is choosing the music. Noel Coward there, and one of the great London songs, London Pride. Have you written any songs inspired by the capital? That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, well, one I can think of was a sort of real four-chord banger.
Yeah.
It's called Hampstead, and Hampstead is for fairs and not for revolutions. I was down the adventure banging two bits of wood together. So as I thought it was, you know, I wasn't really into the kind of political side of punk. So that it was about that, really. And it was just really, you know, people loved it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Hampstead, I think, is the only real London base.
And talking about London as well, I mean, you know, still love London, Adam, still excited to be here and learning new things as well.
Yeah, London's, was it Tide of London, is Tide of Life? And Johnson said that, I think. I'm not sure. When people say, you know, what's your hobbies, I used to say London. Seriously, because I've sort of studied London, and I go to all different parts of London whenever I can on a Sunday morning and have a walk round, and there's always something you can discover about London. It's never-ending, like, you know, finding out that Oliver Cromwell's head's buried in a churchyard in Chiswick somewhere.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, neither did I, but I do now. You know, there's all these legends, I've noticed over the last 15 years there's a lot more literature about that kind of thing, about London. And it's a love affair, really, that never stops. And wherever you go in the world, you know, you still it's London's still home.
And people want to know about London as well, don't they? They're still interested. Yeah. And what about London at this time of year as well? You know, the kind of holiday, you know, the kind of Christmas, New Year thing. I mean, do you like London at this time of year?
I've lived in all... I think it's from living. I mean, wherever you're living, I lived in North London for a while, and Putney and wherever. And I think where you're living, that becomes your turf for X number of years. And Christmas time, you know, I remember as a kid, it was always going down to I think Selfridges and queuing up to see Santa. But it was a big thing. It was Uncle Holly you wanted to see. There was this bloke, Uncle Holly.
What was so special about Uncle Holly?
He was like he was a big bloke, but he was kind of like an elf, but he was Santa's helper.
Right.
But getting an Uncle Holly badge was the thing.
Okay.
That was the thing. So I remember queuing up with that, and I remember one year Freddie Mills was there, the boxer, the great fighter, and they were doing the Freddie Mills punch bag, which was basically Freddie Mills' head, a rubber version of his head that you just could punch. And I remember I was tiny, and I remember massive bloke, curly hair and broken nose, and got down and said, go and hit me. So I sort of hit him, and he sort of rolled over and lay flat on his back. And things like that, you know, it's a lifetime's memory. I'll always hold that representing the things that can happen in London and this time of year. So I think, you know, that kind of story is probably happening out there right now. Some kid going out there and bumping into their favourite
David Hay, yeah. Well, that's a great early London London memory. Well, let's play another record, and then we'll talk some more about Adam's London. In fact, another great Londoner waiting for us up next. We're going to play Anthony Newley and Strawberry Fair. Yeah. What kind of memories? What does this ignite about your London, Adam?
It's kind of, I suppose it's that sort of not necessarily Cockney rhyming slang, but you know, he had the perfect London voice that's been imitated by so many people and so many singers. I think we were talking earlier, you know, like early Bowie, and, you know, he was very much in love with Anthony Newley's pronunciation. But this was a sort of tongue twister, and the way he talks was a bit like the way, you know, a lot of my uncles talked. You know, it sounded very natural, and yet he was a very, very gifted actor. And I think in Oliver, he was the first...
Artful Dodger.
Artful Dodger. And then he goes on to, you know, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And, you know, this guy really did a... You know, very few people can be that good in that many territories. But this one, I remember listening to this one growing up, you know. And when you say, what's it, you know... You know, the way he uses his voice is just so he doesn't waste any of the energy, because again he's talking, but he's not rapping, but he's kind of talking, but the voice is, I think it's a very beautiful sound that he's making, you know, and very confident too, and there's a lot of sense of humour with it. So
strawberries, ripe strawberries. As I was going to Strawberry Fair, singing, buttercups and daisies, I met a maiden selling her wares, faux-de-dee. Her eyes were blue and she was fair, and she rode on a donkey to Strawberry Fair. Rifle, rifle, told a riddle, Ido. Rifle, rifle, told a riddle-dee. Would you like to pick from my basket, she said, singing, buttercups and daisies, my cherries ripe or my roses red, faux-de-dee. You can take a handful, I don't care, as I go on to Strawberry Fair. Rifle, rifle, told a riddle, Ido. Rifle, rifle, told a riddle-dee. So I said to this bird, your cherries soon will go mouldy and bad. Singing, buttercups and what's it? Your roses wither and look all sad. Faux-de-dee. Now it's not to buy such perishing ware that I am slogging it to Strawberry Fair. Oh, rifle, rifle, come and get an earful. Rifle, rifle, told a riddle-dee. I told her straight, I want a girl with a generous heart. Singing, buttercups and who jars without a tongue that is wicked or smart. Faux-de-dee. And an honest mind, but these are rare. I doubt if I'll find them at this crummy old bear. Rifle, told a riddle-ido. Rifle, well, you know the rest, don't you? So I put it to her straight. Now in return for these virtues, I swear, knees up, come and if a knees up, I'll give you a ring for your finger, my dear. Faux-de-dee. So make me your partner and give me a share in church today at Strawberry Fair. Now rifle, top to riddle, Ido. Rifle. Strawberries. Sharpie round tomorrow. The donkeys pitched all the strawberries.
BBC London 94.9, My London with Adam Ant. And there goes another great Londoner, Anthony Newley and Strawberry Fair. So we were talking a little bit about, you know, your initial memories of the capital, Adam. Mm. Let's talk about getting the music bug. And, you know, was there a defining moment? Was there a song, someone's performance on Top of the Pops or listening to the radio where, you know, it just connected with you?
Well, that's basically the next song that I've chosen, really. Tommy Steele. I used to go to Saturday Morning Pictures at the Swiss Cottage Odeon, which was a massive deal growing up. That was my special time. And
do you remember the films you would have seen there?
Yeah, well, this is the one that I saw. The Duke Wore Jeans with Tommy Steele, and I remember him leaning up against a sort of jukebox, and it's kind of, you know, this over with sort of notes on it and stuff, and if you watch the way Tommy Steele performs, there's a lot of, again, there's quite a lot of Bowie there, you know, the way that the neck goes and everything. But the Saturday Morning Pictures was, you know, they used to have groups on, not groups, but the kids would mime to songs. And
the pop stars of the day, before they actually showed the movies.
And I remember seeing, you know, a couple of Tommy Steele films, and I thought that was the first time I thought I want to do that. I really would like to, you know, play the guitar and run around and have girls screaming after me and all the rest of it. And it just seemed a great way out, you know. So Tommy Steele was And he was the first British rock and roll star, and he also wrote his stuff as well with Lionel Bart. And, you know, I've chosen, you know, Cannibal Pot because when I was in a group at college called Bazooka Joe, which is the first group I was in, you know, we could bring songs in, and I brought Cannibal Pot in, and I used to sing it, and it's just a, you know, it's just a weird song to sing. And again, you know, Tommy did actually write the lyrics.
Yeah. I mean, before we hear the track, and I'm looking forward to hearing this, because I don't know this this song, but let's talk, if we can, about Bazooka Joe, your first band, because I was talking to a pal of mine this morning, who's a Northwest London boy, and he said that, you know, Bazooka Joe, sort of mid-70s, were, you know, the kind of North London band. I think Mike Barson's from Madness's brother was in the band, am I right in saying?
It was Danny Barson was our singer, who's Mikey Barson's big brother. And Danny Kleinman was the guitar player. It was really Danny Kleinman's band. And they used to play Hampstead Town Hall. And they used to do, it was a bit like Sean and I. And they used to, you know, sort of do you know, they had a backing vocal. Three girls called the Absorbing Lilettes. I used to go and see them. And then Danny, they needed a bass player. I was at art school with Danny Kleinman. And I ended up joining. And it was a great apprenticeship for me. You know, I probably wouldn't have got into music the way I did. You know, being in the background playing bass and then singing backing vocals on some of their songs. But they did actually progress from that into writing our own material. And the keyboard player, Bill, he wrote Rockin' A-Flat, which Madness covered on their first album. Because the Madness boys used to come to the show at the Stapleton Hall Tavern. And I always remember these kids coming in with their Crombies on and doing like formation dances, you know, and that was the Madness boys.
And that would have been long before punk and two-tone as well. What was the London music scene like at that time then, just before punk happened? I mean, how would you kind of sort of, you know, describe it? And you know, again, I mean, another question I wanted to ask was, you know, when would you have heard, you know, or noticed the first rumblings of what became known as punk beginning to happen?
Well, it was that kind of pub rock era, they call it now, but it was very frustrating because Bazooka Joe, like you say, was a very good band, you know, and deserved a record deal, but you know, it was like Kilburn and the I-Roads were playing a bit, and they were quite punky, and Dr. Feelgood, of course, I saw them a few times. They were amazing. I mean, the energy there, and you just saw these bands that were just so magnificent playing pubs, and they hadn't got records out yet, or they might get a single out eventually, but there was such a lot of talent like banging away, but it was still not quite getting through. So I think really with punk, the instances of that frustration were beginning out of that kind of wall was getting cracked down by people like Feelgood and Kilburn and the I-Roads. And I remember seeing John Rotten turn up. I used to see him a lot, like, turn up to see Feelgood, and you're just creeping in and think, oh, you could just notice a few people that looked a bit different, and it was just starting up from there.
All right, well, we'll pick up the story a little bit later. News and travel's on the way. Adam's next choice, it's My London. Adam Ant choosing the music, and as he was telling us earlier on, this man, a very big influence, early influence, Tommy Steele, and this is Cannibal Pot.
Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. Who's cooking?
It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pot tonight. We've not got a lot to be in the jar tonight. Din, din, tum, tum, chin, chin, yum, yum. It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pot tonight. The guy who worked the mincer, you remember Chinese Louis. Well, one day he went to pieces, poor Louis, chop suey. It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pot tonight. We've not got a lot to be in the dark tonight. Din, din, tum, tum, gin, gin, yum, yum. It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pot tonight. The Turk who used to work here used to serve behind the slab. He ain't behind the slab no more, so grab some shish kebab. It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pot tonight. Well, we've not got a lot, so be on the dot tonight. Din, din,
tom tom, gin gin, yum yum. It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pub tonight. Remember McNamara used to make a hullabaloo. It's quite around the place these days. Do you like Irish stew? It's gonna be hot in the cannibal pub tonight. We not got a lot to fill in the dark tonight. Din din, tom tom, chin chin, yum yum. It's getting real hot in the cannibal pub tonight.
London's headlines at 1:30. I'm Aurelia Allen. Britain's Olympic and Paralympic athletes have dominated the New Year's honours list. The cyclist Bradley Wiggins, who won the Tour de France and an Olympic gold, has been knighted. The same honours gone to the sailor Ben Ainslie, while the Paralympic cyclist Sarah Storey has been made a dame. Six men in India have been charged with murder after a woman who was raped by a gang died in hospital. The woman had been attacked on a bus in Delhi. The incident has provoked protests around the country and the national debates about violence against women. A leaked memo from the Liberal Democrats' head office to the party's MPs has said that they should criticise their Conservative colleagues in the new year, as well as Labour. The memo also says the key message in 2013 will be that only they can build a stronger economy and a fairer society. And London's weather, windy and cloudy today with some rain and highs of 11 degrees Celsius, that's 52 degrees Fahrenheit. BBC London 94.9, it's now 1:31, time for travel news.
And it's looking very slow still on the M25 clockwise between Junction 9 at Leatherhead and 11 at Chertsey after a previous problem. And anti-clockwise, it's slow between 25 at Enfield and 24 Potters Bar after a previous accident. Twickenham, the A310 London Road is closed between the Witton Road and Water Lane. And the B361 Witton Road is also shut because of the Harlequins London Irish game due to start at 2:15. There's also works, which means that the Hospital Bridge Road is shut northbound at the A316. And there are long delays on the A316 eastbound from Apex Corner to the Witton Road roundabout and queuing on the Heath Road on the A305 eastbound approaching Cross Steep. Greenford, the A40, the flyover is shut for repairs. That's causing delays in both directions, but especially slow out of town from before the Medway underpass, and queues on the Greenford Road northbound and slow for the M4 coming in between 3 at Heston and 2 at Brentford. Do update us 020 722 42000 or you can tweet us at BBC Travel Alert. With the Underground, there's a good service, but there's engineering work affecting the Circle District and Northern Lines. On the trains, there's disruption to London Midland services between Birmingham and Euston, and there's no Thames cable car. Fiona McKinnon, BBC London 94.9, next update in half an hour.
You're listening to BBC London 94.9, and this is My London with Gary Crowley.
And my very special guest, choosing the music, I'm so pleased to say, is singer-songwriter and Londoner, Adam Ant, as well. We'll be talking about the new album, which is coming very, very soon, towards the end of the interview, and also a date for the diary as well. If you haven't seen Adam yet playing live, and you've done a whole cluster of kind of guerrilla London gigs over the last couple of years, haven't you, Adam?
Yeah, yeah, starting with... really starting out getting a band together and playing 100 Club, you know, then I just put the Scala and place I used to play and just, you know, and just take it from ground base, really, and just built it up from then. And then it's just, we just finished up at the Shepherd's Bush Empire.
That's right.
Over the course of 18 months, it's been really good. It's been real steady. It's getting back to the basics, you know.
And, you know, live in London, and a rather special show in a way, really,
yeah.
Coming up at the Roundhouse in Camden on Saturday, the 11th of May of next year.
Yeah, yeah, that's 35 years almost.
Is it weird to think of it in those terms?
Yeah, I mean, the Roundhouse was the last time I played. I was supporting X-Ray Specs at that gig, and I think that was one of Polly's last shows there. Unfortunately, she's passed away now. But it was that was like the local place when I was growing up. I remember being like about 14 and getting in there, and one afternoon they used to have a Sunday show, and it was like Genesis playing, and Peter Gabriel had a foot drum and weird makeup on, and then Lowell Coxhill and the whole world, Kevin Ayers and the whole world was on as well, and then David Bowie turned up in a like a caftan in this dress or whatever, and started singing Reflections of a Free Festival, and he was, you know, I remember at the side and they were saying, oh, can I play a song, and he said, oh, go on then, and he just played. So, but it was an all-dayer, and people were like laying down on the floor and everything, And then I played it. I've only played it once, which was with X-Ray Specs supporting them. So 35 years later, lo and behold, I get a chance to
go back.
And well, I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm really
looking forward to it.
Well, that date for the diary is Saturday, the 11th of May. I mean, we talked a little bit about starting out and your memories of Bazooka Joe. Mm. In fact, when you were playing with Bazooka Joe, you saw this London band.
Yeah.
You'd seen some of the members in and around, the London kind of club scene. But take us back to that night and, seeing them at St. Martin's and, the impact that they had on you.
Yeah, well, November 75 it was. And our drummer, that is Mark Tanner, who sadly passed away, he was at St. Martin's doing sculpture. And he got us a gig at St. Martin's College of Art. And it was right at the top of the school, so we had to drag all our gear up. And these four Herberts turned up, and they really just came in. I remember they were really little. Steve Jones was only about 18. And they just looked really young, really sort of little, and they sort of came in, little urchins, and asked if they could borrow our gear. And we let them borrow it.
Did you get it back?
We got it back, but... John Rotten said something at the end about, I just remember he was doing it, and when people were clapping, he was just saying, "Don't waste my time," and eating toffees in between songs, which I thought was quite impressive. And I'd never seen anything like them. And they played really well. They were really tight, especially Glenn Matlock. He was really great. And they played, what was to become, their sort of anthems. And I just, it really had it was all that frustration I was talking about earlier on. There was somebody that doing it, and they weren't playing, Route 66. I'd seen Joe Strummer, with the 101ers and having to play R&B. But after that gig, it all changed for me. And I left Bazooka Joe pretty much after that gig and formed my own group. And I think everybody in the room did. There were a lot of musicians in the room, or anybody that saw them in those early gigs. They were a catalyst. People thought, I'm going to start a band, because they were direct, simple. It wasn't complicated. It wasn't a load of guitar solos. And it was like, there was definitely a feeling something was happening.
Back to basics approach, almost.
Yeah, and they looked great too. But I knew the way they were dressing, because I used to buy my clothes at Sex and Seditionaries anyway. So I kind of knew. I'd been up to see Malcolm and Vivian and Jordan, who worked in there. But it was seeing people wearing those clothes on stage that made the difference. And people like Al McDowell was there, and Julian Temple, I think, so you run into these characters who, it was really the way they were, what they were kind of wearing that you associated with them, because you'd say, you got that in Sex, that t-shirt, and they were really expensive to buy as well, so you had to really want them. So it was a combination of all those, one of the things that makes perfect pop music, or rock and roll, like clothes and attitude. And just being out of the ordinary, and they were great that night.
I mean, you said they were an incredibly tight band as well.
Tight.
I mean, what about the songs as well? I mean, I guess it's easy to sort of forget that. I mean, we're going to play "God Save the Queen" next.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to forget now, isn't it? That at that time, Adam, nobody was writing songs like this for this kind of subject matter, were they?
No. I remember it was almost the first time I'd seen a band using the audience to try the songs out. That's the impression I got. It wasn't like, we want your applause. So there was that attitude that I'd never experienced. No one had really done that to that degree. I'd seen the New York Dolls before. I'd seen them a few years before. But it was nothing like that. It was very, it was more the attitude. And it was just, they were looking at each other when they were playing. They weren't really bothered too much about the audience.
The audience.
It was a complete reversal from, please like us, please like us. And after that, it just seemed a bit redundant to be in a band and play anything that, you hadn't written yourself. Because I remember that, even the songs like, even the covers they did "What You're Gonna Do About It," and it was like, "I want you know, I hate you, baby. I want you know, I don't care." And just that, just something as simple as that, just turned the song round. And it was that attitude that I picked up on it, because it was almost as if someone should have been saying it for a long time, but they were the ones saying it.
God save the Queen! The fashion.
It's BBC London 94.9. Adamant is choosing the music, and such music as well. The Sex Pistols and God Save the Queen. I mean, before going into that, Adam, you talked about, you know, it's almost back to, you know, year zero and starting again. So let's talk a little bit, if we can, about, you know, your early kind of forays as far as, you know, making music is concerned. You know, the first lineup of the Ants, and, you know, what kind of sort of memories of sort of starting out. And also that, you know, that London club scene at that time as well, because you would have been very much a part of that. I mean, you played all those venues, didn't you? The Roxy and the Marquee. And
there was, so looking back now, we were kind of spoilt for choice, and certainly Soho, you know, I think the residency at the Marquee really brought it together for us, you know, because I was being managed by the producers of the film Jubilee that I'd taken part in, and they decided to take a chance and kind of book the Marquee. That's the one thing they did that worked out. And
air of you know, things, you know, kind of changing as well?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, it was a very, dare I say it, there was a certain element of violence and aggression about punk rock that made it kind of, there was not violence all of that, but I'd say danger. You know, when you went on stage, it was a challenge because people were spitting at you, throwing stuff at you. So I kind of learned my craft, dodging bottles, but there was no way they'd stop the show. So it was about the music, but it was usually mixed by roadies and people who didn't like punk. So the sound was always awful. And there'd also be sort of seven or eight bands on one night. So and it wasn't long sets or anything, but it was just, you know, it was very competitive, and it was very, there wasn't a great deal of love between the various bands, but
you were learning your craft, weren't you? I mean, honing your chops, as they say. And you know, so you know, Adam and the Ants were signed by Decca, and then a few independent labels after that.
Do It Records.
Yeah, Do It Records.
That. But it was a very, I'd say, very vibrant time, and you know, possibly the last great effort, you know, in music, in my view, where it really did smash a great big hole in the wall.
You know? Well, you were the, you know, the kind of first true post-punk kind of pop star who went, you know, supernova. I mean, you know, whatever, however you want to describe it. But I'm just interested to sort of know how, you know, that all came about, because, you know, Malcolm McLaren, you know, you met with a few times, and obviously you knew him from before. Yeah. And I mean, you kind of almost hired him as a consultant manager. Yeah, am I right in saying? So, exactly. You know, if you can just talk us through, and then Marco Peroni, of course, your co-writer, who was formerly in The Models, came on the scene as well. I'm just interested as to, you know, how the look and also the sound of Adamant evolved, because nobody looked like you and nobody sounded like you guys as well. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah. Well, I met Malcolm after I did Dirt with What. So I met Malcolm at a party in Notting Hill Gate, and he just came up and said, "Hello, Adam, how are the Ants?" And I was really surprised that A, he knew who we were and we were around, but he just sort of lost the Pistols, and I think he was looking for a band to kind of replace it, and I think he very much liked the following that we had, because we had a really kind of great-looking following. Mohicans, they used to paint their jackets. They looked great. My fans looked fantastic. They were really well-dressed. They looked great. And I started working with him, and I hired him for 2 weeks. He said, "I'll manage you for £1,000. And it was really a learning curve. I used to listen to Malcolm talk about the history of music, and he sat down and listened to my album, and he went through every song, and he helped me with the scanning, and then he played me some great rock and roll records and taught me the structure of songwriting, and then he had this idea for Bow Wow Wow, and I think I did try very hard to be part of it, but I think from Malcolm's point of view, there was a ready-made rhythm section, you know, Dave and Matthew and Lee Gorman. I'd only got in Adam and the Ants for about a week, or a couple of weeks. It took me ages to get him, and he was a great bass player, so that really cheesed me off. But it was kind of, I described it as a mutiny, which Malcolm found quite humorous, but it was kind of out of that, once the heartbreak of losing your mates, when I it really gave me something to think, I'm not having that, you know, I'm definitely gonna, because we'd all sat in the room and listened to the same kind of philosophies, and Bow Wow Wow sound was, I really liked the Bow Wow Wow sound, but I thought, well, that sounds like that, I'm gonna do a very classical drum version of this. So brought in Chris Hughes, who was like a producer first and foremost, but a drummer, and I had the melody in my head for Kings of the Wild Frontier, and I'd seen the Models play with Marco and Terry Lee Mile, and Marco had he definitely sounded, he was the only guitar player sounding anything remotely like Townsend. He had a real oomph. Him and Steve Jones, I suppose, took that banner that Pete Townsend had set. You know, he used to play very, you know, loud, simple chords and very... So I went to see him and just told him what had happened. And I described it to him, and he said, all right, then.
All right, then.
It really was like that. But the thing that made it work was we both knew exactly what we didn't like. We knew exactly what we didn't want to do. So it made it a lot easier. We both like glam.
Well, that brings us very nicely to our next record as well, because we're going to play a little bit of T-Rex. And, this man, was an influence, wasn't he? We're going to hear Get It On.
Oh, massive influence.
Tell us about meeting him, asking him for his autograph.
Yeah, well, that's why it's so London. When I thought of London, I often tell the story of meeting Bolan on stage, because it's important to me. You know, I was in... the record store in Oxford, Oxford Street, I can't remember which one it was, but I went in there with my mate Nick, and his wife was in love with Mark Bolan, and there he was, there was Bolan, and the thing about it was he looked exactly the same as he did on the television. He looked fantastic, little denim jacket with studs in it, hair was perfect, tiny little guy, straight satin trousers and little Mary Janes, but he looked like the guy just stepped out of a record sleeve, and Nick, my mate Nick Salomon, who's got a band called Bevis Frond, actually, but he said, I'll get his autograph for the missus. I said, you get it. And I went over and I said, can I have your autograph, please? And he said, I said, no, would you mind giving me your autograph? He said, certainly not. So I thought he meant no. So I was sort of walking off, he meant, no, certainly not, I don't mind. So he signed it for me, and he was so gracious... and so, relaxed and just genuinely gave off a real kind of, I was pleased to see you. And years later, when people were asking me for my autograph, it's something that, is in the back
stuck
of my memory.
With you. Yeah.
So it was a great example. And I think he was an incredible, underrated sort of songwriter, but a great pop star, great, pop star. But to actually see him in his prime... standing there, and it was just all there, and it was just so positive. You thought, if you're going to do the job, if you're going to take this as a profession, try and do it as good as he did it, because he really did made it, it's one of those things I'll never forget,
you.
My London Adamant is choosing the music, and one of the great London pop stars, Mark Bolan, of course, and T-Rex, and Get It On. Let's just give people a flavour, if we can as well, Adam, about, you know, London and what you love about the city as well. I mean, you spoke earlier on about, you know, discovering, you know, new things about the city. You know, I mean, if you're not working, what's a great day out for you as far as the capital is concerned?
I like... places like Chiswick House is one of those ones. It's a bit further out because it's on the it's the sort of Alexander Pope territory, and the architecture out there is really beautiful. It's like Georgian, and the actual, you know, the Louis Napoleon III was exiled there, and there's a great deal of history. But it's like a miniature park, but it's all been designed by Lord Burlington, who did the Burlington Arcade. And I would really, that's the place I'd go if I do get a moment. You get a day off, just go up there to Hogarth House is right there as well, right next door. And Hogarth was obviously very influential on the punks, and certainly Malcolm. You know, he got the idea for World's End from one of Hogarth's illustrations. So it's quite a, you know, it's an absolutely, it's like going, if you've ever seen this film Barry Lyndon, you know, on a sort of summer's morning, go down there. It's like literally walking onto a set of Barry Lyndon. It's beautiful.
I mean, we mentioned when we came on air that there's a new album. I think your first album in something like 17 years, which is coming out in January.
January
the 21st. And of course, as mentioned, that very important, it sounds as though it's going to be a celebratory performance, a show at the Roundhouse on Saturday the 11th of May. Let's talk about this album, though, if we can, before we hear our final track. Okay. Adamant is the blueback hussar in Marion the Gunner's Daughter. I mean, is this a London album? I mean, has the capital influenced this? What can people expect, basically?
Well, it's sort of 17 stories. I think, you know, over the, you know, coming back and discussing where you've been and some of the highs and lows, it's pretty much answering some of those questions within the songs, like the track Marrying the Gunner's Daughter is really autobiographical. And the single Cool Zombie is about when I lived in Tennessee for 3 years, which is a period that I'd not ever really mentioned in my life. And, you know, living way up in the boonies, right, you know, on the Vale of Tennessee, in this tiny little town called Dayton. So this story's about, like, where I've been, what's been happening, and some of the ups and downs, and trying to confront those and write about those too. But I love writing songs because it's just stories that intrigue me, and there's 17 of them on the record. And I'm very traditional. I'm doing a double gatefold vinyl. I'm doing the opposite of what you're supposed to do these days. So, you know, we'll see.
Well, look, listen, it's been lovely spending this time with you. Really appreciate you coming in. Look out for the album. As I said, that's coming in January. That show at the Roundhouse on the 11th of May. I guess we're kind of almost going sort of full circle, really. Another great Londoner is going to wrap things up for us. Tell us why you've chosen the Kilburn and the High Road song, Rough Kids, Adam.
Oh, yeah, well, that was... You know, you asked me earlier about, you know, when did you realise punk was coming? I think this record was like the preemptor to Anarchy in the UK. And it's just really Ian Dury, you know, he used to, when we had dances, a weekly dance at Hornsey College of Art, Kilburn and the High Road would turn up. And it was just, no one had sung with that broad Cockney accent before, and, you know, there she goes and fall off the stage. And we supported him a couple of times. And it was just so London. It was just, there was no, you know, he's talking about Upminster, he's talking about places in London you never heard, for the rhyming slang and the way he looked. And they were, it's an extraordinarily good record, Rough Kids. It's really underrated. It's a great record. And I think it set the kind of bar for, you know, what came later with the Pistols.
Rough kids play rough games and kick tin cans. They bother and make nuisance. They clamor someone else's fence. Rough kids, mama, 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 no idea. They
London 94.9, here's latest travel news.